Thanks for joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Shackman. We hear so much today about wealth inequality in our social and political dialogue that it's perhaps reached the point where we either don't pay attention anymore or we simply are numb to what it means. However, the recent list of the annual Forbes 400 Wealthiest Americans provides some context that should be a wake-up call to all of us. Perhaps the most shocking is that the wealthiest 20 individuals in the United States today hold more wealth than the bottom half of the entire U.S. population. But having said that, how did we get here, and what can we possibly do to get out of it? We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Chuck Collins. He's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and directs the Institute's program on inequality and the common good. He's an expert on U.S. inequality. He's authored several books, including Wealth and Our Commonwealth. And he's the co-author of a new report entitled Billionaire Bonanza, The Forbes 400 and the Rest of Us. Chuck Collins, thanks so much for joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Great to be with you, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. In any conversation about this, it's worthwhile to begin to think about how did we get here? This wasn't always the case, and it really does seem like they were incremental steps along the way.
Yeah, I think that people kind of point to the late 70s, 1970s, as the time when we stopped being an economy where most people grew together, meaning incomes rose around the same rate for rich and poor, to a society that's dramatically pulled apart. And you're right, it's really been a period over really three decades that we've seen wages pretty much stay stagnant, you know, as a result of the global economy and sort of a pushback by large corporations. And then the more subtle undercurrent of this growing concentration of wealth at the top. The median wealth for most people in this country was about $85,000 in 1990, and today it's actually gone down. It's about $81,000. And meanwhile, there's been this tremendous gushing up of wealth to the point where, as you know, our report reveals, you know, the Forbes 400, the wealthiest 400 individuals in the United States, have as much wealth as the bottom 61% of the population now. That's unprecedented. Maybe 100 years ago, it was that concentrated, but this is new and alarming.
Well, there are parallels, actually, to 100 years ago. At the time, we were going through a major sea change as the Industrial Revolution came on. Right now, we're dealing with globalization, we're dealing with technology, and a profound shift in the nature of work and the nature of how we relate to each other. Are there parallels that we can learn? And in order to address this, is it something that we should have been addressing in incremental stages over the past 30 years as the nature of work changed, as globalization changed, and as technology played a larger and larger part in the American workforce?
Well, you're right, Jeff. There's a lot of parallels to the Gilded Age 100 years ago, including this idea that there were 400 families that captured a huge amount of wealth. I would say one thing is that the discussion about inequality a century ago was incredibly robust. It was at every level of society. I think we're actually getting there right now. I mean, 3-4 years ago, I kind of would have said, boy, we're really not addressing this. But now, post-Occupy movement, Thomas Piketty's book about inequality, Bernie Sanders candidacy, these issues of inequality are now starting to get as engaging as they were a century ago. One thing that people really talked about a century ago was they were fearful that this concentration of wealth would undermine a self-governing democracy. There was a lot more focus on democracy, and you know, maybe in our historical imagination, it wasn't that long ago that we threw off a hereditary monarchy. So people were fearful that we would go back to this almost sort of having a loyalty of wealth. And the only other parallel, and we could talk more about this, is that we reversed it. I mean, people organized in the 1920s and 1930s and really over several decades to reorganize the rules of the economy to reduce these concentrations of wealth and expand the middle class in the post-World War II era. So the other lesson is this is not, we're not stuck with this. We can change this, this toxic inequality, as people did after the first Gilded Age.
And yet one of the ironies that is counterintuitive in all of this is that at a time when it should be easier to organize and easier for people that are unhappy with the status quo to interact because of technology, because of social networking, because of all the tools that are available to people in terms of communication, it should be easier to do what happened 100 years ago. And in fact, very little of that is happening.
I think I agree. I think that you know, in the first Gilded Age, they had local newspapers, a very robust, small populist press that was sort of part of helping develop an analysis. Maybe now we're just flooded with information. But I would say that the other thing that's changed is the story, the narrative of, or ideology of wealth and deservedness is much more kind of embedded in the culture. So, you know, some of us will say, oh, these inequalities are alarming and it's because the rules of the economy are rigged and we need to change that. But a lot of people still are kind of like ho-hum, you know, okay, well, that's, you know, good for those billionaires. They've worked hard and they've created things the society wants and they're disruptors to the old technologies and they should be rewarded for that. So we have a pretty powerful tolerance for high levels of inequality because we live with this, what I would call a mythology of deservedness and meritocracy, that, you know, people have wealth because they deserve it, because they worked harder and they're more virtuous. They're the great makers in our society, and other people don't have wealth because they don't work as hard and they're not as virtuous and they're the takers. And that's a just wrong and very destructive mythology.
How did that mythology become so ingrained in the current popular culture?
Well, you know, if you open up the you know, when there are stories about the very wealthy, what you usually hear about is, you know, well, what was it, the qualities that you took to this? What risks did you take? And it was, all the stories are told sort of in the paradigm of what did you as an individual do to create this wealth? As opposed to how did society create the fertile ground, and through public investments and you know, say take public investments in technology, how did we create the context, the commons that made individual wealth possible? So I think that we're very comfortable and used to the individual success story, but we don't really see the invisible factors of that truly make that kind of level of wealth possible. No individual does this alone. No individual creates that, you know, claims that level of wealth outside the context of the society they live in.
In the Gilded Age, there was this notion, and I forget for the moment who said it, that behind every great fortune, there's a great crime. And that was the popular kind of belief at the time. No longer the case.
Yeah, I think there's a little more of an unabashed celebration. Although I think one of the things that's changing is, you know, again, I said we have a high tolerance for inequality, but there's more and more people now who are, if you look at polls, they say these levels of inequality are dangerous, they undermine democracy, and they affect me individually. Like, people are starting to make the connection between, wow, I can't rent an affordable apartment in the town where I live because these large hedge fund guys are buying up all the real estate. You know, people are starting to put that together. We believe that, you know, I should say, polls historically have shown people think, oh, I don't care how wealthy the wealthy are, as long as the rules are fair and there's social mobility, meaning if somebody really wants to work hard, they can move up the economic ladder. Well, I think what happened is in the economic meltdown of 2008, 2007, 2008, people realized the rules are rigged, that the big financial industry people have a huge amount of political power and wealth, and that they're tipping the scale in their favor. And at the same time, social mobility is declining. If you want to live the American dream, you're better off moving to Canada than being in the United States now, because our mobility is so stagnant. So I think that is expanding the constituency of people who are alarmed and concerned about extreme inequality.
But while it puts the focus on the extreme inequality on Wall Street and among bankers, the nexus of the conversation shifts to Silicon Valley, for example, where we see a similar kind of extreme wealth, but without the same kind of reaction to it.
Yes. I mean, I think that there are these pockets of just unabashed celebration, just as there was in the Gilded Age. But I think that, you know, you go outside the bubbles of Silicon Valley or outside some of these bubbles of private wealth creation, you know, more and more people are like, what's going on here? I mean, just take students today. You know, I spoke at a college class yesterday. I did a little private anonymous survey among 20 college students. The average debt that those students are going to have is $73,000. We know the average student debt is $33,000. There's, you know, 40 million households now holding student debt. That is a clear example of how these inequalities cut generationally, and nobody can make a good argument about how that's good for anybody. How is it good for your 22-year-old to have $73,000 of debt as they start their work life? So those are the kind of juxtaposition, the, you know, the Zuckerberg billionaires versus the $1.2 trillion of debt held by all these young people. And I think that's politicizing a whole new generation.
How do we begin to address this and have an even broader conversation about it without it declining into a kind of class warfare?
Well, I think a question once you start to talk about these inequalities, a certain group of people will just tune out because they feel like, well, you're just attacking wealthy people. And this is where actually I found I personally grew up in the 1%. I'm the great grandson of Oscar Mayer. I was, you know, fortunate to grow up in an affluent suburb of Detroit, Michigan. And I've been part of a number of organizing efforts to organize people in the top 1% to speak out about the dangers of these trends. And we have this network called the Patriotic Millionaires, which, you know, is 225 CEOs of companies who are really eloquent in saying, look, this isn't about class warfare. I mean, even Warren Buffett himself said, there is a class war in America, and my class is winning, meaning the wealthiest class is winning. And, it does kind of keep us stuck if we keep saying, oh, well, we hate the rich and we want to attack the rich and we're targeting the rich. That's how people sometimes hear the discussion about inequality. But I think we should get a little more thick-skinned and just say, look, this is a system change. This is a system. This isn't necessarily about, you know, evil and greedy individuals. The way the system is rigged right now is perpetuating these inequalities. Of course, there are individual actors and there's individual responsibility within that. There's a segment of people in the 1%, you know, like the Koch brothers who use their wealth and power to rig the rules to get more wealth and power. But that's not actually the majority. There's a lot of people in that 1% group that are completely alarmed about these inequality trends and actually are publicly speaking out, like the Patriotic Millionaires. So that, I think, helps break open that stuck conversation about class war, just to say, you know, these inequalities are bad for everybody, including the very wealthy.
To what extent is this inequality baked in to a rigged political system today, and the extent to which the political system and the financial system are so tied together makes this even more complex?
Well, that's the moment we're in. I mean, former President Jimmy Carter said we're now living in an oligarchy. The New York Times reported that half the money that's in the current 2016 presidential cycle came from 158 wealthy families. So we're looking at a political system now that has effectively a wealth primary, meaning that the candidates, before they stand for a vote, before the voters, they've already been winnowed and shaped and messaged by the big wealth holders, with one obvious exception, Bernie Sanders, who's the only candidate who said, I'm not accepting money from the billionaire class, and has a mass, small donor base. But otherwise, if you want to be a candidate, a credible candidate today, you need a billionaire to stand by you, and ideally 4 or 5 billionaires. So I think we're seeing that the influence of money on our elections and on the lawmaking legislative process is again parallel to a century ago during the first Gilded Age, when people used to talk about, you know, the complete capture of our political system by the super wealthy.
Can you imagine a time when there is enough political pushback to this that it becomes potentially revolutionary, that in fact it suddenly becomes in the interest of politicians wanting to get reelected to begin to seriously address this issue because the pressures have simply gotten too much?
Well, see, I think the pressure is building. If you look at students with debt, 40 million households, if you look at the people who feel who have seen their standard of living collapse, the collapsing middle class, that's an angry and mobilized constituency. Some of those folks are mobilized, you know, in a pro-Donald Trump, anti-immigrant kind of reactionary populism. But nonetheless, the undercurrent is that we're looking at right now is an electorate, is a populace that understands the economy is rigged against them. And so all the polls now show support for taxing wealth, 70-80%, you know, raising the minimum wage, clear majority, eliminating money in politics, taxing billionaires, using government to reduce inequality. All those things the public supports. What we have now is a political system where that's blocked. We can't pass the reforms that are needed. So I think just the pressure is building and will continue to build until there's some kind of realignment or revolution or repression. You know, we're heading toward a showdown, if you will, over these issues of wealth inequality in our culture. And I think that the Bernie Sanders moment is interesting because he's been saying the same thing for 30 years. But what's happened is there's a huge, he's connecting and resonating. He's speaking a truth that many people are hearing, maybe for the first time, and are saying, yes, I agree with that. So there's, I think, all the ingredients of a political realignment, sort of a tectonic shift in the electorate around these issues.
Of course, the other part of that, the corollary of that, is the populist message from people like Donald Trump, which really plays on the worst fears that people have about exactly what we're talking about.
Yes, and again, the parallel to a century ago is such that we've had this a paranoid regressive populist tradition in the United States, you know, that says, okay, inequality is growing, wealth is concentrating, so let's blame new immigrants, let's blame unwed mothers, let's blame people of color, or, you know, pick the vulnerable, powerless constituency that you want to target. And that has been the strategy how ruling elites have often maintained power, is by encouraging a scapegoating culture. That's the great deflection. So here we are, objective conditions are such that, you know, inequality has grown. How do some segments of the elite respond? Unscrupulous politicians are blaming the new people, the new folks that showed up, nurturing those grievances and deflecting them onto other people. So I think I would just say that that's a symptom of growing inequality. It's actually typically what happens. It's how the powerful try to maintain power.
In this report that I referenced at the outset, you talk about a number of very specific public policy initiatives that can begin to address this. Talk about that.
Well, we think that there's, we know a lot about what would reduce these inequalities because if we go back to the years after World War II, we taxed wealth at substantial levels, high incomes, and we invested in things that created opportunity for other people, debt-free education, first-time homebuyer programs, infrastructure that provided good jobs. So some of what we know is we just need to re-implement some of the policies we know that historically have reduced inequality. One of our challenges today is that the ultra-wealthy are using the offshore tax system to move their money out of the country. Technically, it's still in the country, but it's sort of booked in the Swiss bank account or the Cayman Islands or in some subsidiary corporation, or they're using these complicated trusts to sort of hide and mask their wealth. So before we implement a program of progressive taxation, we at the same time need to sort of close up all the escape hatches that hide and enable the very, very wealthy to move their money away. I mean, there are also the things that we can do to raise the floor. You know, the reason inequality is less in Canada and most European countries is that they have higher minimum wages, guaranteed health insurance, preschool, and decent public education for universal. So we can do things to raise the floor, and we can do things to level the playing field, like campaign finance reform. But in the end, we have to tax these concentrations of wealth and invest it in things that create opportunity for everybody else.
Where does the political initiative come to do this? When we look at, from a practical point of view, when we look at the way districts are divided today, when we look at the way legislative and congressional districts are apportioned, we see nothing that's going to change before the 2020 census at the earliest.
Yeah, I think we are up against a political structural problem now. That's where I think states and localities should push ahead, where they have room to move. But we need to organize as much as possible in every congressional district to nurture this realignment. So let's, for example, here's this one example. What if all the student debt holders, graduates and current students in every congressional district were organized into, debt-free education caucuses, and that they organized and educated their community and held the candidates accountable on issues of student debt? The parallel is, in 1933, people organized around Social Security. You know, Social Security came about because people organized what they call Townsend clubs in every congressional district, pushing for the creation of Social Security. They became very powerful caucuses, and every candidate in the end won or lost elections based on their support of the Townsend clubs. So we need to kind of organize formations around these issues of inequality. Student debt is just one part of that coalition. So I think that's the formula for reorganizing at the local level.
Talk about this from a generational perspective. And you mentioned being on a college campus yesterday and talking to students. What are you hearing from millennials and young people about this today?
You know, it's interesting. On the one hand, it's news to them that it doesn't have to be this way. And I think that is part of, so much of how we experience the economy as individuals kind of quietly suffering, so when I talk to students who have huge amounts of debt, they think, well, this is just my personal problem. I say, no, it's not. It doesn't have to be this way. I mean, look at history. We had, 13 million people were educated after World War II through debt-free education. I mean, what a great investment that was as a society. There's no good from you having all this debt. But you have to believe that, A, it doesn't have to be this way, and B, you have to kind of organize to push for a different system. And so there's some students who are still in that individual, this is my individual problem mindset. But there are other students who are saying, yes, this is the galvanizing issue. In fact, one of the student debt coalitions has a wonderful saying, which is, if you owe the bank $70,000, the bank owns you. But if you owe the bank $1.2 trillion, you own the bank. And that's the kind of mindset where it's like, yeah, you have huge amount of power. And you have, and we see in Iowa where the first Iowa caucuses happened, there's 93,000 student debt holders that are forming a caucus that are pressing the candidates on this issue of student debt. That's an example of a generational organizing that I think will be part of the realignment of politics.
Does the distrust this generation has of government and of institutions and of traditional organizing, does that play a role, a negative role?
It does play a negative role because people don't think of government doing great things. You know, the post-World War II generation can look at the New Deal and say, wow, government kind of got engaged and actually brought us out of a depression, built an interstate highway system, made public investments in technology that built the internet age. You know, people can point to, my grandfather or my father got a free college education, and we bought this house here on a 1% veterans mortgage or 1% FHA mortgage back in the 50s, 60s, 70s. So people have more concrete examples of how government made a transformative impact in their lives. Whereas a lot of young people have been weaned on the kind of Reagan-era thing of, oh, government's part of the problem, not the solution. So I think you're right. There's some skepticism to overcome there. And part of it is to say, well, government can do some, you know, we the people together using our capital could create a system where young people don't have to be indentured servants to the student debt industry.
Is there reason to think, and this comes back to this broader historical narrative and what happened 100 years ago during the Gilded Age, that this is simply a cyclical aspect of American history and that we will, in fact, move beyond this simply by virtue of how these cycles tend to play out?
Well, you know, I think one of the takeaways from the French economist Thomas Piketty is that actually a system that moves toward greater inequality is kind of the way it's wired, and that the years from 1930 to 1970 were kind of more of an aberration than a cycle. Meaning, you know, unless we intervene in the system, wealth will just continue to concentrate. It may lead to extreme levels of disruption, but it could just continue on as it is until we become kind of like Brazil, you know, with a very tiny wealthy elite and everybody else, you know, living in some level of immiseration. There's no cyclical reassurance here that somehow that will stop. It's really a human engagement issue. We have to organize to change the rules back to retake it, our democracy. Otherwise, the machinery of inequality will just keep chugging along as it currently is, and it will get more concentrated.
Chuck Collins, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks, Jeff. Enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. And thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you'll join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share it and help other people find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.